Hello and welcome to The Violin Chronicles, a podcast in which I, Linda Lespe, will attempt to bring to life the story surrounding famous, infamous, or just not very well known, but interesting violin makers of history. I'm a violin maker and restorer. I graduated from the French Violin Making School some years ago now, and I currently live and work in Sydney with my husband Antoine, who is also a violin maker and graduate of the French school, L'École Nationale de Lutherie in Mirecourt. As well as being a luthier, I've always been intrigued with the history of instruments I work with, and in particular, the lives of those who made them. So often when we look back at history, I know that I have a tendency to look at just one aspect, but here my aim is to join up the puzzle pieces and have a look at an altogether fascinating picture. So join me as I wade through tales not only of fame, famine and war, but also of love, artistic genius, revolutionary craftsmanship, determination, cunning and bravery that all have their part to play in the history of the violin. This show is sponsored by Tarisio Fine Instruments and Bows. And right now I would like to talk about a formidable database you can access today, if you wish, called the Cosio Archive. For people who listen to this podcast, something that you might be thinking when you're listening to me telling the stories of violin makers is you would really love to see pictures of the instruments that they make. And for that, you have the perfect resource. Here is Jason Price, director of Tarisio, to tell you about it.
Yes, like the Cosio Archive. We now own it, maintain it, and are continually adding to it. Over 100,000 instruments in the database, over 4,000 makers, which we are following and tracking, 200,000 auction prices. It's really quite cool. If I pull up the stats for, you know, a maker like Ruggieri, I get 336 instruments by Francesco Ruggieri. It's a unique resource, and we hope it's really useful.
Yes, and so what I love is that often in some databases, you just get one photo per maker, but in the Cosio archive, for example, for Ruggieri, you're able to look at the maker's whole career in photos and you see influences from other makers. Mm-hmm. You can see the dates where his sons are working for him and you can see examples of that work and the style and how it's... Yeah. They're similar. For example, you can look up Vincenzo Ruggieri and see how his style is similar to his father.
Yeah.
There's a violin in your archive, 1680, called the Milanolo, which is really beautiful.
Yeah.
Which is a small violin. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of his work when he's working with his sons in when mm-hmm. the workshop was very successful. And then there's a violin from 1650, which was his earlier work. Mm-hmm. I think maybe my favorite name for an instrument is the Admiral Buckle.
Admiral Buckle, that's wonderful.
His life and his, it kind of reads like something out of a Jane Austen book.
Wonderful.
And then there's a 1673 cello, which is really beautiful. And the quality of the photo is amazing. You can zoom right in and see the texture of the varnish. You can see mm-hmm. the purfling. You can tell that the purfling's been tinted.
Yeah.
There are examples of from 1692, so his later work, and 1695, right to the end of his making career, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. Good. I'm really, really happy that you find it useful.
To have access to all these photos, what's the process to subscribe?
The annual subscription is $100 and allows you unlimited access to as many makers and as many instruments as you want to look at.
Yeah, and I find the auction results quite helpful as well as a violin maker because we're often having to research different prices and you have to look at a lot of different resources to get an idea of a market value of an instrument.
Yes.
And so that's just one of our tools that we use in that process. Yes. And so you have your auctions, the photos, the auction results, and there's also the carteggio. We get the emails every week.
Good. I love the carteggio project. It's something I really enjoy. We try to make it long form discussions on things that are interesting corners of our world. And we invite some of the some really distinguished people who write for it and have, frankly, very, I think, inspiring and fascinating things to say.
You don't have to be a subscriber to the archive to have access to the Carteggio articles. You can sign up for them, and that is absolutely free. So there you have it. If you would like to subscribe to the Cosio Archive, read a Carteggio article, or browse the auction catalogue, go to tarisio.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to the life and times of Francesco Ruggeri. As we have seen in the last episodes, Ruggeri is living in an exciting time for musicians. There are advances in string technology, and Francesco's smaller model of cellos are selling like hotcakes. Over in Venice, opera is taking off, and it's just the best thing ever to go and see the latest arias. Ruggeri's boys are growing up now and can start helping out with all the orders. Or are they sick of hanging around outside the walls of Cremona where more interesting things are happening in town? Starting from the late 1660s, the Ruggeri family is referenced in church and civil records with the nickname Il Père or detto Il Père. He also puts it on his labels. No one really knows how he got this nickname or what it means. Perhaps it was to distinguish him from other Ruggeris in the area. In their parish of San Bernardo alone, there were five other Ruggeri families, and two of them were Francesco's brothers.
My name is Duane Rosengart, and I'm a double bass player in the Philadelphia Orchestra. One interesting document I think we found, actually, I think it's actually in that parish church of San Bernardo, is a document of 1669 that pertains to a brother and nephew of Francesco Ruggeri. So it may or may not have anything to do with violins, but this document calls Francesco's brother Ruggeri detto il Pair, which means called the Pair, P-E-R, right? And that document is from August of 1669, and that, up till now, is the earliest written record of this, call it a nickname, call it a suffix, whatever you prefer. But that suffix or moniker or nickname was used to identify Francesco Ruggeri and his siblings and their descendants. Why is that important? Nobody, even if they spent a lifetime, could count how many Ruggeri families lived in and around Cremona. I wouldn't say it's as common as, not nearly as common as Smith or Jones, but it may be almost as common as a name like Brown or Green. You know what I'm saying? It was the amount of material. Just when I think back to the 1990s that Carlo Chiesa and I sifted through, both in churches and in the legal records of notaries. There's many Ruggeris, and some could read, and some could write, and some were illiterate. And sometimes they spelled it with two G's, other times with one G, sometimes with one G and an I before the E-R-I. And, you know, it could drive you mad.
At this time, another maker with a very similar name of Ruggeri was apprenticed in the Amati workshop for a few years. He was in his late teens, but soon, over the next 5 years, he would move to Brescia, get married, and start a workshop in that city of his own. In the 1680s, Francesco's eldest son, Giovanni Battista, was a witness at a wedding, and the priest writes his name as G.B. Pear, with Pear replacing his last name, Ruggeri, so that was the nickname that they put on the labels, remember? So we can see that the family was well known by this name. It could also have been to stop confusion with Ruggeri over in Brescia, but we will probably never know. The fact is that this name, Il Père, is on his labels and records from now on. Before the Great Plague, 30 years ago, Cremona was a city of about 30 to 40,000 people. Now, in the 1660s, its population is just 10,000. And yet the violin makers, or luthai, were doing well. The reputation of a Cremona violin meant that four industrious workshops were trading in town. And as the years passed, Francesco's children grew up and the boys started helping their father in the workshop, making it a hive of activity. And the Ruggeri workshop, under the guidance of Francesco, was distinguishable with its own style and way of making instruments. Jason Price.
I was just going to say, stylistically, there really are some
you know, you look at them from 10 feet away and there's some obvious similarities. They're both an Amati model. But when you start looking up close, you see some things that are different. The head of a Ruggieri is really distinctive, a tiny eye, very, very small chamfer. The body of a Ruggieri tends to be a little bit more pinched in arching. The sound holes tend to be a little bit more sinewy and wiry. They don't tend to have the classical poise that an Amati does. And then they're missing some things like obviously the central pin, which is all the Amati makers and disciples had. Ruggieris do not have those. So they're similar from 10 feet away, but quite distinct once you get up close.
Yeah, when you say they made a lot of instruments, is that violins, cellos? What are there a lot of?
It's certainly not violas, that's for sure. And that's a separate topic all on its own. But, you know, why weren't people making violas?
Unfortunately for you.
Exactly.
In 1677, Giovanni Battista Ruggieri, the eldest of the Ruggieri boys, married and moved out of home into another parish of Cremona with his wife briefly, but soon they would move back and continue to work with his father. Giovanni Battista was good friends with Niccolò Amati's son, Girolamo II, who was only 4 years older than him. And when Giovanni and his young wife had a child of their own, they asked him to be godfather. During this time in the 1670s and 80s, the Ruggieri workshop was at its most productive. Francesco had his four sons working with him, making many instruments. In 1685, a year after Niccolò Amati died, the 56-year-old Francesco Ruggieri found himself involved in a court case.
Ruggieri was sort of got himself sort of mixed up in a situation with a fake label in his instrument.
Jason Price.
Yeah. That's right. So this was in Modena. So a musician appealed to the Duke of Modena for relief or for some sort of a, you know, injunction against the person who had sold him a violin that was supposed to be an Amati because it had an Amati label, but turns out it had a Ruggieri label underneath that.
Yeah, underneath.
It's crazy, huh? It's crazy. I mean, these old tricks, they never, they've been there from the very beginning. Yeah, and this, the cool thing about this is it happened like just a couple years after Niccolò Amati had died that this came out, I think. I think it was, he died in 84, and I think it was like in the 80s that this happened. And, you know, and the price difference between an Amati and a Ruggieri is what was at stake. I think that he asked for some sort of either compensation or relief or something because, you know, the idea was an Amati is worth five times what a Ruggieri is worth. I don't remember the actual numbers, but it's a ratio like that. It's like,
I think it was the pistoles, but in different accounts they give different currencies. So, but then I was looking up to see how much a pistole was worth, and in one account, one pistole could buy you a cow.
Oh wow! Right.
An Amati violin could buy like four cows, which sounds expensive to me.
That's amazing. It really tells you everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That one, an Amati was commercially that much more valuable. And two, there was enough demand for Amati that people were either making counterfeits or selling counterfeits one way or another.
Yeah. And he got in trouble for it. And I'm like, it couldn't have been him. He would have taken out the label or like not put his label in. And like, you wouldn't stick a label on top of your own label. I mean, if you're going to be fraudulent, you do it properly.
I think that there are some examples in the 20th century who were happy to put in whatever label you'd want them to put in there.
So you, for example, you're an expert, right? Yes.
Absolutely. That's the,
So say, hypothetically speaking, someone comes to you and they give you a violin and they say, look, I bought this. It's a Vium. And you can see from across the room that it's not a Vium. What happens today in this setting, in that situation?
In that situation, you make sure they're seated so that they're not wobbly. And then you you try to see what they want you to tell them. And if most of the time they're coming to you because they want you to corroborate something they already know. And for me, I think you have to be super direct in these matters. You have to tell people what it is, but how you get there certainly requires some finesse that you don't want to offend someone. You don't want to make them feel like they've made a bad purchase. You don't want to, you know, make them faint and fall over. But 9 times out of 10, when they come to you with something that isn't something, this isn't going to be news that you're giving them. Yeah, you have to be gentle with these things, but super direct and super truthful at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's this example I have of a story that the Vice Chancellor mm-hmm. of Sydney Uni told me
yeah.
first time I met him. And so the story was that, well, it's a true story. This happened to him. The first year he was the Vice Chancellor of Sydney Uni, an elderly lady died, and she bequeathed in her will, the university received 2 paintings, and one of them was a Picasso and the other one was a mural. So the Picasso, he said, first of all, they got someone to look at them and they said, well, yeah, this is a Picasso. These are, you know, it's this. And the university just, they couldn't pay the insurance to keep them for even a few months. So they, mm-hmm. there were experts from 2 big auction houses in London. You could imagine who they were. And they did like a VM. They jumped on the first plane. They came out to Sydney. They looked, and it was his blue period. It was incredible. They sort of had this big kind of battle for who was going to sell it. It was taken mm-hmm. back to England. Yep. It made the cover of the auction catalog. It sold for a record price. Uh-oh. It was huge, record price. So the university mm-hmm. is like fantastic. Like universities in Australia, they need sort of a lot of private funding. So heaps of millions of dollars.
Good.
Yep. The second painting was a mural. They mm-hmm. like, cool, we got the Picasso, mm-hmm. we've gotten millions. And they said, well, actually, no, the mural, we have to take that to Paris because you have to have the right expert to be sold. It has to have the right mm-hmm. expertise. So they're like, sure, take it to Paris. But they said, but we have to tell you that if it's a fake, it's going to be destroyed. And so this is how it happens.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's a movement, and especially the contemporary art world. The Warhol Commission won't even look at something until you give them permission to destroy it if it's a counterfeit.
Yeah, so either you get the certificate to say what it is, or you've agreed for its destruction. Yeah. And they're like, well, this is okay. It's
so you get a pile of ashes back. Yeah,
we've got the Picasso was real, right? Like the mirror. They send the mirror, and it was a fake, and. So mm-hmm. it was destroyed. But their yeah. argument is, well, how can we know that someone isn't going to take this painting and sell it as a fraudulent
yeah.
thing? And I was just wondering, what would the violin world look like if that's what...
if that happened? That's a very good question. Very good question. What do you think about it? I mean, how would you see that?
I think we don't often say... Well, I don't know. If it was sold as that, and it was very, and I know there has been cases where things have accidentally been sold as something and they haven't seen a little iron mark in it saying it's something else, and that's put the violin maker into a lot of trouble. But I can, I mean, at the same time, I can understand the art, the laws surrounding it, because they're like, this is copyright. This is infringement of copyright. You can't do this to a song.
Yeah.
You're selling this as someone else's work. They did that painting.
Yeah.
And normally copyright is, I think it's 70 years after the death of the person. But then some people own the copyright. I mean, like nobody owns the copyright to the Strad model. So, yeah, I don't know. I was just a bit shocked by it. And I was like, oh, we're sort of in the same world.
Absolutely. I find it fascinating and shocking at the same time. I think if you applied that to the violin business, there would be some things that would, it would miss all the subtleties of, you know, Völler copies from the late 19th century, Vion copies, loose copies of a Guarneri that, you know, that's had a Guarneri label in it when they left his workshop. But they're not forgeries. They're not counterfeits. They're things that are made as, well, they're traded now. with full knowledge of what they are. And it sort of would be a sad erasure of history if you had to do that, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know. And there's always a part of you that might be saying, you know, maybe with the paintings, like maybe it was a real one and they've destroyed it.
Here's what happened. There was a virtuoso court violinist and composer working for the Duke of Modena. That's about 100 kilometers or 62 miles from Cremona. His name was Tommaso Antonio Vitali, and being a well-known musician and composer, he thought he would buy himself a violin worthy of his station, and that could only mean an Amati would do. They weren't cheap, but he had important things to play on this instrument, so he managed to find himself one of these famous Amati violins. Presumably he didn't go to the workshop himself, but acquired it in some other fashion, a travelling salesman or another violinist dealer, perhaps. So anyway, he gets his violin and pays 9 pistoli for it. Now, in one source, I found you could buy a cow for 1 pistoli, which gives you an idea of the value of an Amati at the time. So whether it was 9 cows or a herd of goats, we don't quite know. It was expensive in any case. And everything was going just fine until he saw the label inside his instrument peeling at the corner. And as the Niccolò Amati label was slowly peeled away, it exposed a Francesco Ruggeri, detto il Per, label. Shock, horror. He had been scammed. This was bad news for Tommaso, who had just forked over a considerable amount of money for this instrument, to find out that it was, okay, a violin from Cremona, but a Ruggeri instrument. A Ruggeri instrument was only worth a third of that of an Amati. Vitali, finding himself in a pickle, petitioned the Duke, his employer, to see if he could help get his money back in this case of fraud. This story tells us a few things. 1. Niccolò Amati's violins were considered the cream of the crop, even during his lifetime, or in this case, shortly after. 2. Ruggeri's instruments were considerably less expensive, but also well made enough to be passed off as an Amati to the unsuspecting. 3. You can't always trust what is on the label. And 4. That unscrupulous people wanting to make a quick buck have been around since the dawn of time. Jason Price.
Have you heard of an author called Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes, absolutely.
And he wrote a really, a book I love is called Blink. I don't know if you've read that. And he talks about...
Blink, yep.
Yeah, I feel like he talks about a thing called the adaptive unconscious, which is...
Okay.
It's everything that happens in a few seconds when you first see something that you can't explain. He often talks about people, he takes an example of art experts having, they can't explain it, it's a feeling that they have when they see an instrument, not an instrument, when they see a painting. And do you... Do you have the feeling when you see an instrument as an expert?
I think that sort of uncategorizable experience of seeing something is incredibly important. The instinct you have when you see something is incredibly important, but it's also equally important to corroborate that and to challenge that. That when you see something, when someone flashes a violin in front of you and you just say, oh yeah, it's a viom, that's great. It's great that you have that instinct. It's great that you've seen, you know, 700 viomes that you can recognize the 701st. But the better expert is the one that then unpacks that and says, hang on a second, let me just sit with this a little bit and make sure that all the parts check out and that it corroborates that, that I'm not doing it out of posturing. I'm doing it out of actual intellectual rigor of looking at the instrument, not just my instinct. And then it's also important to challenge that, to say, you know what, hang on a second, I saw a viom 6 months ago that didn't have this thing here. And why does this have that? Those two things are super important. You have to have the instinct, but you also have to challenge it.
Yeah. And that adaptive unconscious, it's kind of like it's a lifetime's experience, because he'll talk about people that reading people as well. And it's because you've spent your life doing it. It's not, it just doesn't, you're not sort of born with it, or I mean, I don't, maybe someone is, but normally it's thousands of connections being made from seeing thousands of instruments, and which I think AI could never really, AI can maybe categorize things and help with elimination, but they could never synthesize completely the entirety of the object, because he gives this example in the, I think it's the Getty Museum, they wanted to buy a statue and it was $10 million. Mm-hmm. And they did, I'm not sure if it was Getty, it was a big museum in America. And mm-hmm. they did all this scientific testing on it for the materials, where it came from. They did every scientific test you could do. But then when they put it in front of an art expert, they just said, I hope you haven't bought this. I have a really bad feeling. And they couldn't say why. And they couldn't go back to the museum and say, well, this guy felt a feeling. In the end, it was a fake, but it was so well done that it ticked all the scientific boxes. And that's that would be your human using their sort of little supercomputer. Synthesizing it all together.
No, you're absolutely right. It's that that the human judgment is irreplaceable, and you certainly don't replace that with scientific evaluation, for sure.
Yeah, and it's something that's hard to quantify or explain. Because do people say to you, "How do you know? Like, how can you tell it's this?"
I think it actually is almost more athletic than anything else. I think it's just because you've done the work, that you've seen the previous 400 examples of that maker, and you've actually studied them. You've made binders, or you've made folders, and you've compared one to another. You know the early period, you know the late period, you know the problematic ones, you know the ones that are accepted by some people but not by others. That's just doing the work. That's like an athletic experience, not like voodoo. The part of our business, not violin business, but in general, but the arts business, that I find a little bit dangerous is the sort of posing as expert. I am expert because I beat my chest and say that I am. That doesn't work. You know, experts aren't fancy suits. Experts aren't people who can, you know, proclaim something as a work of magic. They're doing it because they've studied it.
Yeah. And it's hard to measure that depth of knowledge.
So the next time you buy yourself a Niccolo Amati, be sure to go to a trusted source. And this is where an expert can help you. And as in the art world, there are different experts who have expert knowledge on specific makers. So there you have it. At the end of this episode, we leave Francesco in a pickle with his instruments, and his workshop is in full swing with his sons, the Ruggeri brothers. I'm sure they were well known about town, strapping lads that they would have been. And next week, we will see the shenanigans the boys get up to and some big moves for the workshop. And that will be the final episode on Ruggeri before we move into the wonderful life and career of Giovanni Battista Ruggeri. Thank you to my fantastic guests, Dr. Emily Brayshaw and Jason Price, and Dwayne Rosengard. And to end, here is some viola music for Jason. Well, viola and cello, actually. This is Lisa Palandi and Tippi Vecchiovalve from the Australian Chamber Orchestra playing the Sonata Representativa. You will hear how the composer is playing with the capabilities of the instruments, imitating bird songs. It's quite lovely. It was composed around 1669, so it's around about now in Francesco's life, by von Bieber. To support the podcast, you can leave a rating and review on your listening app, and I hope to catch you next time on the Violin Chronicles.
Thank you.